Good morning, everyone. I'll just say for those of you who are new here and who don't know me, my name is Shanti, and I know in our program for today it says that Asha and her husband David will be giving service. So I just wanted to let all of you who don't know that I am not Asha. This, in fact, is David. So as is always true, there's a wonderful little story that goes with how it is I came to be up here today. This week is what is called Spiritual Renewal Week up at Ananda. It's actually a very sacred and wonderful time for all of us who've been a part of Ananda for any period of time, as I'm sure you can tell just by the what it's called. It is a week where people go up and consciously and actively engage in being spiritually renewed. And for a number of reasons, I was not able to go this year, which was unusual. So I gave myself the gift of having 3 days of quiet and silence, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I thought, everybody else is up there, I'm just going to take the time and be quiet. And in fact, I did that Friday and Saturday. And then last night, as I was stepping out of the shower and getting ready to go to bed, I checked my cell phone and realized that David Praver had called me. And as soon as I looked at the phone and saw David Praver's name, I said to myself, he's calling to ask me to give service tomorrow morning. Instantly. Not a really difficult intuition, but nonetheless, that's what happened. And I just froze. You know, I don't know what it's like for anybody else who gives service, but for me, when I give it, I usually spend the week before thinking about the topic. Not that I necessarily study it, but I think about it, I meditate on it, I certainly pray about it. And then the day before service, I always spend the day in seclusion with that topic in mind, maybe listening to some talks that Swamiji's given about it, or Asha. You can hear, but it's not something that I would just stand up and do. So I'm looking at my cell phone, and I'm beginning to tell myself all of why I don't need to respond to David's call. And, you know, I'll say this to you now because, of course, it was perfect. I got into this discussion with myself, but I need 3 days of silence. I never get time for silence. I deserve this. I don't have to show up at the last minute. Furthermore, I could get up there and make a fool out of myself. I don't want to make a fool out of myself. I don't even know what the topic is. And in a moment, it just flashed through my mind, and I was saying to myself, but what are you going to tell David? He left a message that you didn't know you got a call. I mean, are you going to lie? And then I said to myself, maybe I'll just tell David, and this is true, this is all going on in my mind, I'll tell David, the devil made me do it. Now, mind you, this is just the whole conversation that I'm having, and I was really resistant to calling David back. But I knew the whole time I was trying to make every conceivable argument, and you know, nobody would have blamed me had I called David and said, I really can't do this. This is beyond me. How am I going to know what to talk about? Whatever I would have said, I knew for sure that whatever was going on, that David and Asha and everybody would have said, of course. Who would get up and just give service, you know, 8 hours later, 10 hours later? And it even dawned on me, maybe something happened to them. Maybe they were actually in trouble. Still, I was looking to the devil. But I called David, and of course, David asked me to give service today because Swamiji really needed Asha to be up at the village with him, just helping him prepare for his trip to Los Angeles. And of course, I know there are ways that only Asha could help Swamiji. I'm sure there are many people up there helping, but there's something that she would bring that nobody else could. And I just, you know, I had a moment. I'll just digress for a minute and tell you a very brief story that just literally flashed through my mind. One day, a number of years ago, I was visiting my partner, and a bat flew into our bedroom when we were up in the bedroom. And I happen to be phobic about things flying around when I'm in an enclosed space. And at first I thought it was a bird. Then he said to me, "That's no bird, that's a bat." And I pulled the covers over my head, and I kept like this. And he said to me, "What are you doing?" And I said, I'm collecting myself. At which point he said, "Honey, I think you ought to get out of the room and I'll deal with the bat." So I said to David last night, "Give me 5 minutes, I'll call you back." And he was actually being quite lovely about it. "If you can't do it, don't worry. Of course, we understand." He wasn't in any way making me feel like a fool. But you know, the whole time this was going on, this part of me back here that I was trying really hard not to pay attention to was saying, "You know you're going to go in there tomorrow morning and give service. You know you are." Because for me, it's not like this is a dharmic thing for everyone. But I knew that for me, it was the right thing to do for many reasons that actually aren't terribly important as we go to talk about Satan today. But I just knew that I had to do it. I was just under that blanket collecting myself is really what I was doing. And of course, then I called David back and I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And then I said to him, "Do you know what the topic is?" And he said, "No." So I was over at Barry's house and I got on the computer. Now I knew I was going to drive home because I was going to have to be with, I had to read the reading. I had to, and I don't have any of that at Barry's. So I just jumped on the computer to look at what the talk was. There's the talk. "Does Satan exist?" I was like, "Oh, thank God I didn't tell him the devil made me do it. It just would have been awful." Recently, I've been doing some reading because I'm giving a series of classes right now on the chakras. And I picked up a wonderful book by Joan Borisenko, who's a woman who I've followed for years and really loved, clinical psychologist, worked at Harvard for years, really in the end spiritual teacher to many, and just a wonderful woman. And there's a great story in this little book I was reading this week. The story is that in Boston, there's a Jewish woman, Mrs. Cohen. And Mrs. Cohen goes to her travel agent one day, and she says, "I need to go to Nepal." And the travel agent says, "Sophie, have you lost your mind? You can't travel to Nepal. You have to take 2 planes, you get on a train, you go through places where there's guerrilla warfare. I think you have to get on a camel in the end, and you know, you're going out to this wilderness in the mountains." Sophie Cohen says, "I've had a revelation and I have to go." So he goes, "Okay." So she does it. She takes her backpack, she packs in there some Jewish rye bread, which is notoriously hard, and some hard cheese, and she makes this trip. And she finally gets to this ashram where she's headed. And after all this traveling, anybody in the room ever been to Nepal? It's quite the trek just to get there. And she's waiting to see the teacher. But when she gets there, she finds out, no, you're going to have to wait at least 3 days to see him. Everybody's waiting to see him. The grounds are just filled with people. So she waits patiently. And then they said, "And when you get in there, you're only allowed to say 3 words to him." So finally her time comes, and she walks into this cave-like setting, and it's filled with thousands of candles, and there's this man with his eyes looking up at his third eye, deep in thought, and her heart is just touched by a moment of deep recognition and joy. And she goes up, and she takes him by the shoulders, and she says to him, "Morris, come home." It's such an adorable story, maybe particularly adorable if you happen to be Jewish, but obviously there are a lot of people here who got it. But what's really telling about this story is that we all spend our time or so many of us have, thinking that the way to find God is through some mystical experience, through behaving like a saint, through practicing all of these hard practices, sitting for hours and meditating. And really what this story says is that really the path to God, who is within us, happens in our everyday life. It happens in the most mundane and simple ways, that everything in life becomes an opportunity to remember that God is already within, that God is at home. He's right with us all the time. We don't have to go anywhere. We don't have to be anything other than who we already are. There's that wonderful story of a rabbi who dies and goes to heaven, and he says to God, "I want you to know I've really worked hard." He said, "I've tried to have the strength of David and the wisdom of Moses," and he quotes all these other saints, and God looks at him and says, "Well, that's all wonderful, but did you ever think about just being yourself?" You know, and it's like that. It's like in the most simple ways. So that story from Joan Borisenko's book came to me last night, and I thought, you know, it's just like that with the devil. We tend to think, and sometimes, like last night, where I wanted to say, the devil made me do it, as if that was some force outside of me that could force me to do something, as if God exists somewhere else. And usually that somewhere else is just, well, those special people can do it. People who have lived in Ananda for 40 years, or Swamiji, who had this extraordinary experience at age 22, or Jesus, who we can't really even talk to about it, or Yogananda, or Buddha. And the more responsibility we want to take for our lives, the more opportunities we want to grab. We have to begin to say, it's all right here. There's nothing anybody's doing that we can't do. God is not a mythical character in long robes and with a big gray beard that maybe someday, probably only once we leave our body, and then how are we ever going to remember anyway, because nobody comes back and tells us that God really exists. We have to do a 180-degree turn, and we need to find him inside. Well, of course, the same thing is true about the devil. The same thing is true about evil. There's not some being in a red jumpsuit with big ears who's going to perpetrate these horrible things on us. It's not how it happens. The devil is, to a large part, within us. As Sister Gyanamata said to, in one of her letters that she wrote to one of the students, she said, Satan is our consciousness. And if we fill our consciousness with love and with joy, if we make those our practices, there is no room for Satan to exist. But how do we do that? You know, it's not always easy. There's a story that I read in a wonderful book called Callings. This is a book that literally changed my life. 1 year in my life, three people gave me that book, three different people. And when September of that year came, and I was about to do a 3-week seclusion, it dawned on me perhaps I was supposed to read that book. And I did, and that was the beginning of my journey back to California and into the Ananda community. And, you know, here we are still telling that story. But it's a really extraordinary book. And at one point, Greg Lavoie, who wrote the book, says, whenever we go to do something big, practice compassion in a big way, take a step towards our own transformation, even just practicing kindness or simple things like change a job, change our partner if we need to, whatever it is, he says, every devil in hell will step up to meet you. You know what that means? It means we get challenged like that. Of course we get challenged. Who's to even say that the challenges are bad? Of course we need them. That's what we read every week, that even fear, like shadows on a statue, give light and hope, light and substance to hope. You know, we know We may need that tug of war with the devil, with Satan, so that we get stronger, so that we can actually see who we are. There's that beautiful song of Swamiji's that says, without darkness, where is light? Sorry, I just blocked on the words. That's terrible. If it were not for men's woes, who would smile at the rose? And there's many, many sentences in there that say that for us. We need these things. This is exemplified nowhere better than it is in the Bhagavad Gita. I'm sure many of you know this story, really in the Mahabharata, but the story comes to a head in the Bhagavad Gita, which are these wonderful teachings, and many of you probably know this, but there are two sets of cousins. And it comes to a moment in time, we can't tell the whole story, of course, but where Krishna, who's representing God, and Arjuna, who's the student, are riding in a chariot. And that is the opportunity in that chariot for Krishna to really teach Arjuna everything he needs to know to remember who he is, that he is one with God. So they're taking this ride. The challenge for Arjuna is that he has to go to war, and who he needs to go to war with are his cousins. And he has loved these cousins. They were little boys together. They grew up together. They adored each other. And now he's being told, not only do you have to go to war, but you have to kill these cousins of yours. And so this story takes place on the battlefield with Arjuna saying, why? I don't get it. Now, what we know is that all of the brothers, all of the cousins, represent something. There's a lot of allegory in the Gita. So the five good brothers, the Pandavas, they all represent one of the chakras, some level of energy. And the Kauravas, the evil forces, along with the horses and the teachers and everybody in the Gita, represent in this story all of those aspects of ourselves that we need to overcome to remember who we are. And it's not easy. And Arjuna knows it's not easy, but Krishna is saying to him, Arjuna, everybody else's life depends on you. If you don't get it right, if you don't do this, if you don't find the power, and just parenthetically, Arjuna represents the third chakra, fiery willpower. Nobody can live through this experience. You must do this. And Arjuna's trying to get it, but he's saying, but I don't want to. I love them. I'm used to them. They're how I recognize myself. And he starts bargaining with Krishna. He says, but do I have to kill them? Can't I just, like, you know, move them out of the way a little bit? I mean, is it sounding familiar? It's everything that we need to come up against. And we struggle and we fight. We don't want to let go. I was listening to a talk that Asha gave. She just said it perfectly. This is years ago. But in one sentence, she said, can't we have Saturday night and Sunday morning too? You know, and it's just so right. We don't want to let go of these things. We think we can maybe just be a little spiritual or be spiritual when it serves us. But if I really want to go out and do whatever, we can all fill in our blanks. I'll just have a little beer tonight, or I'll just sit in the movie and watch three movies in a row today, or maybe I don't really need to meditate or pray, or I could do that on Sundays, and maybe I don't really have to. And we just start bargaining with ourselves. That's what I was on the way to doing last night. I was doing this. I was like a living example of it. I was even going to say the devil made me do it, as if there was some other force that could make me do it. It's as if I couldn't go deep and gather all that strength and say to myself, you will do this. You will show up there tomorrow. You're going to know that, and you're going to remember, Shanti, what you tell yourself every day as often as you can. God is the doer. If you make a fool out of yourself, so be it. It's in his hands. That's what was meant to happen. Quit taking yourself, this little self, so seriously. This is the devil. That is what's happening. It's not a huge, big thing. It's an attitude that we have. It's looking at somebody and saying, why would they behave that way? Or my God, who dressed them this morning? What are they doing in those plaid pants? Or, you know what I mean? It's a judgment. It's an attitude. It's an action. Most of us in this room are probably not people who are out there contemplating at this stage in our evolution bank robberies or murders, but we're committing them in our minds because that's what attitude is. That's what judgment. That's what these little behaviors, every time we think we're letting ourselves off the proverbial hook, we're just allowing a little bit of evil, a little bit of Satan. Maybe I can just tell a little lie this one time. It doesn't really matter if I download music from the internet that I'm not supposed to. Everybody does it. So what if I copy a program and cheat those people out of their money? Or, you see what I mean? We all, it's so common these days to live in certain ways. But every attitude, every thought, every moment of this life is this struggle, if you will, between upward moving forces that take us to spirit or downward moving forces that keep us locked in ego. We can do it now. We can come up against it. We can find the power that Arjuna needed to find to understand. Yes, he needed to kill those cousin brothers of his. Of course he loved them. Of course he was used to them. Of course he was going to miss them at times. Yes, he was a human being. But he had to do it. If he didn't do it, everybody would die. You get the message? If we aren't willing to gather our strength and come up against one tiny little thing after another, well, we may not really die in the literal sense, of course we will, but we're dying. Martin Buber, the great theologian, he said, life needs to be addressed. Life must be addressed. And when are we going to address it? In each moment. What else are we here for? The sole purpose of life is for us to be able to remember who we really are. There's nothing else that goes on that matters. Now, it doesn't need to be this huge, serious, like, oh my God, the devil's waiting to get me. It's just about paying attention, moment by moment, doing the very best we can. Everything's directional. What's right for me might not be right for any one of you. What takes me in a good direction may be a backward slide to you. There's no real judgment here. Just looking in ourselves and knowing that we're doing the best we can. Swamiji often tells this example about that. He says, you know, if Jesus or if Gandhi came up to you one day and said, I just had a great idea. I'm going to start a business and make $1 million. You'd think to yourself they lost it. It would be a serious backward slide for them. On the other hand, if somebody who's never been able to make their life work, hasn't been able to commit themselves to anything, comes up to you one day and says, I just got it. I have an idea for a business. I'm committed. I'm going to make this business work and I'm going to make $1 million. Well, we would all be applauding them. There's no rule here. Every single one of us are our own blueprint. That's what this whole spiritual anatomy and physiology is. It's unique. There are as many paths as there are human beings. And we have to remember that. So all we need to do is check in with ourselves each day and say to ourselves, am I moving forward or am I just letting myself sink back down into habit? Now, having said that, here's one little glitch, and it was in our reading today. And that is that Master Yogananda says Satan exists. It's not simply in the minds of men. He goes on to say that Satan is really as much of a manifestation of consciousness as love is. And that was God's will. And he talks about why. I mean, I certainly wouldn't know it, but he talks about needing to have that tug of war just to keep life as we know it going. He very cutely says if there was no evil, if there was nothing for us to work on, everybody would just blend back into the divine. There wouldn't be a life. There would be no reason to have life, nor would there be a force keeping us out here. So that complicates the picture a little bit. That says we need to be really as diligent as we can be. We need to put ourselves in a position as often as we can for grace to happen. Because in the end, it's God's grace that's going to save us. In the end, it's God's grace that had me even thinking last night, you know you're going to call David and do this service. When I was driving home and getting ready to do a little reading, a lot of meditating, I thought that was just grace. I could have just as easily made the other decision. I often do. I'm sure. I know it in so many ways every day. So how do we do that? Because there's all this habit tugging on us all the time. Just as I'm talking about this issue with grace and setting ourselves up, this book came into mind, which I think I've mentioned here before, and I know others have, called Left to Tell. Very, very powerful book written by a woman who survived the Rwandan Holocaust, the genocide that took place there, by being locked in a bathroom with seven other women, a bathroom that was 5 feet by 4 feet, with seven women for 3 months. And while she was in that bathroom, she was listening to this. I'm sure many of you know the story of the Rwandan genocide. It happened in almost all of our lifetimes. But it was brutal. It was extraordinarily brutal, I think in a certain way, because it was hand-to-hand combat. And so the one tribe was using machetes and just literally chopping up these people and killing them in very awful ways. I mean, consciously, thoughtfully, babies in front of mothers, mothers in front of their children. So this woman, Immaculée, was in this bathroom and was listening to her brothers and her parents and her dear friends, people she loved, being killed right outside of the window. And the people who were doing the killing were screaming her name. We know you're here somewhere. We want you to know what we're doing. Just the most awful of the awful. And she was angry with God. She was a devout Catholic. But she was so angry with God in those moments. And she was fighting with Jesus, which was her, how she spoke to God. And she kept saying, how could I believe in you? How could I know of you? How could I trust you? And it came to her that she had no choice but to begin to pray. And literally, she tells you by the end of the movie that she sat there sometimes for weeks and never came out of prayer. But the minute she decided to pray, the minute she surrendered to open herself to hearing what it was God had to say, the minute she put herself in a position for grace to descend, Jesus appeared before her. And he stayed with her for the entire rest of the time. In a vision, he was constantly there with her so that she could live through and know that she needed to live through what a week earlier she was feeling. She just wanted to give herself up and die. We have to think, what are those things that I can do? What are those actions? What are those thoughts, those behaviors that will put me in a position that God could speak to me if, in fact, he wanted to? How can I be here? How can I get quiet? How can I be open? What are the practices that I need to do? Of course, there's a never-ending number of them. That's what meditation is. That's what prayer is. That's what a practice of devotion is. I recently read a little article where somebody was saying, every day of your life, take 1 minute and offer gratitude for something new, something you haven't offered gratitude for. And whoever was writing this article said, that was pretty easy for the first 3 weeks. Then it starts getting hard. Then you have to start looking at what it is we really have to be grateful for. Because in the practice of looking, in the practice of offering the gratitude, in that moment of stopping, of awe, of wonder, God can speak to us. Because when we focus on our prayers, when we write an affirmation, when we gather with friends like this, when we're right here, right now, right in the moment, no matter who we are, what we've done, what lies we've told, what lies we will tell, here is a moment where God can come to us. And of course, that's exactly what Divine Mother wants. Exactly. In every great religion, it says it. In the Talmud, in Judaism, it says, you take one step towards God, he'll take 100 towards you. In the Gita, it says, lift one arm up, God will lift 2 arms down and grab you. In the Bible, for those who have ears to hear, to them gave he the power. God wants us back. He wants us to feel his presence. He wants us to know that love. We just need to decide that we're willing to be tested, to be challenged, to go through whatever we need to go through, and to each day, to the very best of our ability, here and here and here, one moment at a time, as the Buddha says so clearly, just be here now. And then God will come to us and he'll find us. I was thinking this morning, we read this festival, which we're about to read in just a couple of minutes, every week, every sentence in this festival is filled with possibility. Every sentence in this festival is filled with the way. Everyone, Lord, with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my soul, and with all my strength, I choose thy love. I choose only thee. Even if we just shorten it, even if we just say over and over, I choose only thee. I choose only thee. Divine Mother will come, and in ways and times we won't be able to remember even how it happened, we will find ourselves more and more and more lifted up into that extraordinary state of grace, which is the answer to every prayer that any one of us in this room ever puts out, even though we may not use those words. It's what we want. We want that unconditional love. We want it now. We want it always. We're doing everything in the world. We want unconditional joy. We want inner peace. And all we need to do, it's so incredibly simple that we could miss it. All we need to do, I choose only thee.